Yeah, so it's 8 o'clock, and I think we have everybody that I saw online. Perhaps we can start at this point. I believe last time we just finished out the first chapter, Devashisdham. So, do you want to do a recap of that before you start, or were you going to like summarize the next chapter, or how did you want to do it?
No, I think I can just say a few words about the previous chapter and then draw attention to some of the things that connect with this new chapter. So, we are now going to begin this chapter 2, Brahman Purusha Ishvara Maya Prakriti Shakti. And we've just finished chapter 1. Indeterminates and cosmic determinations. Indeterminates, cosmic determinations, and the indeterminable. And the essence of that first chapter is the relationship between the known, the knowable, or unknown, and the unknowable. And Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that reality being conscious and infinite, radically infinite, there is a dimension to it that is infinitely unknowable. And so whatever it is that we can know, there is something that exceeds that. And that is what takes us along a track of negations. So that we can experience something but always transcend it in something even greater. But on the other hand, it also takes us along a track of affirmations. Whatever we transcend reveals an even greater being. So this is the two sides of our experience of the divine. Of reality, and Sri Aurobindo points out that there is a difference in the nature of the experience from what is available to us in the ignorance, in the avidya, and what is available in the vidya, or in the knowledge. In the ignorance, there is an essential operation within a divided consciousness. And as a result, these two realities, like all other opposites, exist as separate realities. But on the other hand, in supermind, they exist as essential parts of the one. And so we find that Nirguna and Saguna Brahman are two sides of the same reality, two descriptions of the same. Sri Aurobindo is going to, in this chapter itself, point to ways by which that unknowable presents itself, its self-presentations. One of the primary self-presentations is as being, consciousness, and bliss. And so he talks about these three as primary self-presentations that each have trinity connected with it. First, in fact, each connects to a way of manifesting itself as a trinity, and then each of these manifests through a trinity of relation. They depend on something to experience them, and a power that connects the experience and the experiencer. So that is the basis of what Sri Aurobindo has taken us through this particular chapter, you know, pointing to the fact that there is a, you know, a realization that there is a utility to both sides of the realization, to the experience and relationship with Saguna Brahman, that is also present to us as Satchit and Ananda, and a relationship and experience of that which at any level gives us freedom from any formulation of the divine. So it's almost like Sat and Asat, if you want to call these the two dimensions of radical infinity, that they are descriptions that coexist. And the Upanishads frame this by exactly describing Brahman in these two terms. Sri Aurobindo does the same in the little tract called Sri Aurobindonishad. In that, he begins by saying, one and indivisible is the Brahman, Sat and Asat are its names. You know, Ekam Eva Dvityam Brahman, Satasat Rupam, Satasat Atitam. His forms are Sat and Asat, and he is beyond both Sat and Asat. So I think this was the essence of what we've covered. This new chapter called Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti is presaged in this chapter which we've just finished. And I want to draw attention to the paragraphs in which that is presented or that is prepared for us. And unfortunately, I'm using a very old edition.
What are you looking for?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I'm looking for. It's about 6 pages from the end, a paragraph which begins, our fundamental cognition of the Absolute, our substantial spiritual experience of it.
Sure, that's like page 328 on the PDF.
Okay, so if we look at that paragraph, we'll see how Sri Aurobindo foregrounds the self-presentation of being, which is how we experience it. Our fundamental cognition of the Absolute, our substantial spiritual experience of it, is the intuition or the direct experience of an infinite and eternal existence, an infinite and eternal consciousness, an infinite and eternal delight of existence. So he stages this essential intuition of being in terms of this Trinity. It is as if our self-evident self-experience rests on something which has these three primary attributes. And these primary attributes can each become a foregrounded, can become that which leads the rest. So he says, in overmental and mental cognition, it is possible to make discrete and even to separate this original unity into three self-existent aspects. And our experience of reality is a mental experience of reality. If we were to rise into a cosmic experience of reality, that would be the overmental experience of reality. Even there, we would find that these three are discrete and separable. That's the point he's making, that it is the nature of what is called avidya, or the ignorance, that separates the divine, or that through which the divine separates itself into different kinds of experiences. For we can experience a pure, causeless, eternal bliss so intense that we are that alone. Existence, consciousness seem to be swallowed up in it, no longer ostensibly in presence. A similar experience of pure and absolute consciousness and a similar exclusive identity with it is possible. And there can be too a like identifying experience of pure and absolute existence. But to a supermind cognition, these three are always an inseparable trinity. Even though one can stand in front of the others and manifest its own spiritual determinants. So that's how we see at once that the nature of the supramental experience, the nature, as we have pointed out, Sri Aurobindo has articulated himself, that he was not so much interested in man's experience of God as in God's experience of himself. And that God's experience of himself is the supramental experience. So that transition into that consciousness gives us a different kind of experience, in which these three are always an inseparable trinity, even though one can stand in front of the others and manifest its own spiritual determinants. For each has its primal aspects or its inherent self-formations, but all of these together are original to the triune absolute. So there he tells us the trinities that are extended as self-presentations of each of these self-presentations of Brahman. Love, joy and beauty are the fundamental determinants of the divine delight of existence. And we can see at once that these are the very stuff and nature of that delight. The reason he is doing this is he's trying to show us that when we enter into the determinable universe, the known and the unknown, we find that there are certain principles along which such a determination is occurring. These principles are the truths of being. The truths of being rest upon the self-presentation of being. And so that's the reason why these become the important qualia or qualities that are experienced of the divine. Then we have the powers of consciousness. Then we say they are truths of its being, native to its consciousness, powers of its force or existence. So too it is with the fundamental determinants of the absolute consciousness, knowledge and will. They are truths and powers of the original consciousness force and are inherent in its very nature. This authenticity becomes still more evident when we regard the fundamental spiritual determinants of the absolute existence. They are its triune powers, necessary first postulates for all its self-creation or manifestation. Self, the divine, the conscious being. Atman, Ishvara, Purusha. So, these three, which are the self-presentations of being, of pure existence, its sense of self, which is the Atman, its sense of conscious being, or in other places he has called it, of personhood. In what ways is it a person? Is the Purusha. And in what ways is it the Lord? Here he calls it the divine. But by that what he explicates is that the sense of lordship, the sense of control by will, is the Ishvara. So we have these three extensions or self-presentations of pure existence. To each of these we have a trinity. And that trinity is connected with the other two, actually, because we find that the self is, he talks about here it here as self as inevitably appears. In the next paragraph, he says, and founds its manifestation in a trinity.
It cut itself off, and I was on my way back up, and I kept...
I think somebody is...
Simon's voice, yeah, it's gone now, so probably he realized it in a second.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That self as inevitably appears and founds its manifestation in a trinity of self as subject, self as object, and self-awareness holding together self as subject-object. See, in a similar way, though he does not extend the other two, we can say that Purusha, certainly like that, we find the relation between Purusha and Prakriti. And we find the relation between Ishvara and Shakti. Now, Shakti or Prakriti are to, we find with the self-Atman, these have their correlates of consciousness force or chit. Shakti is the power of self-manifestation, which is consciousness force, or the will of consciousness, what he calls over there knowledge and will. And these are held together by delight. Delight is the middle term. Delight is the term, that's why the Upanishads say that out of delight all this comes. By delight it is maintained, and into delight it returns. It is through an act of delight that Sat and Chit enter into a relationship, which is manifested as whatever we experience in the world, or in the cosmos, the cosmic existence, the manifestation. So here Sri Aurobindo stages the powers or truths of being which enter the manifestation, and the relations through which they enter the manifestation. And this is what he is going to expand on in the new chapter that we have just entered. One other small thing I want to point out, which is in the paragraph, I think one page later, the paragraph that begins, "But neither is the separate cognition of them entirely an illusion or a complete error of the ignorance. This too has its validity for spiritual experience." Can you tell us which page that's on, Shyam?
Can you repeat that once more?
"But neither is the separate cognition of them entirely an illusion or a complete error of the ignorance."
I see that as page 331
PDF page 331.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So that paragraph towards the end, he points out how, again he reiterates the difference in experience between mind, overmind, and supermind, and he points out how there is a kind of a transcendence that oversteps or goes beyond anything that we can say. But at the same time, he points out how even in the fragmented reality of mind, the truth of these things is intuited by us. Because as a matter of fact, the fragmentation is also a self-appearance. If it is a self-appearance, it is only something that is held, through a certain concentration of being, a tapas of being. But nevertheless, behind it is the fullness of the experience of all the other planes. This is something which is primary to Sri Aurobindo's teaching and must be understood. That there is no absolute division. There is no absolute other than the absolute. It sounds like a tautology. It sounds like the Islamic statement, there is no God but God. But this is exactly what he's trying to point out, that even in the most divided condition, the totality of the truth is intuited as the self-evident reality of each being. So he says, towards the end of that paragraph, "Supermind keeps always and in every status or condition the spiritual realization of the unity of all. The intimate presence of that unity is there, even within the completest grasp of each thing, each state given its whole delight of itself, power and value. There is thus no losing sight of the affirmative aspects, even when there is the full acceptance of the truth of the negative. The secure base, the overmind, keeps still the sense of this underlying unity. That is, for it, the secure base of an independent experience. In mind, the knowledge of the unity of all aspects is lost on the surface. The consciousness is plunged into engrossing exclusive separate affirmations. But there too, even in the mind's ignorance, the total reality still remains behind the exclusive absorption and can be recovered in the form of a profound mental intuition, or else in the idea or sentiment of an underlying truth of integral oneness. In the spiritual mind, this can develop into an ever-present experience. I think these are important keys that will lead on or prepare the new paragraph, that because there he's taking up the ways by which this reality becomes self-manifest.
Yeah, thank you, the wishes done. So perhaps now we can read the first paragraph from the next chapter.
Yeah, sure. Unless anybody has any questions or comments leading to it.
Justin Ayers, would you like to read first?
I would like to listen today. I would like to be able to receive and be in the context of this writing. So I'd like to listen, please.
Yes, absolutely. Joanna Zweig?
My birds are making a lot of noise. I think it would be better if I read later.
Sure. I can start. I can go first. Brahman Purusha Ishvara, Maya Prakriti Shakti. It is there in beings, indivisible and as if divided. Gita. Brahman, the truth, the knowledge, the infinite. Taittiriya Upanishad. Know Purusha and Prakriti to be both eternal without beginning. Gita. One must know Maya as Prakriti and the master of Maya as the great lord of all. Shvetashvatara Upanishad. It is the might of the Godhead in the world that turns the wheel of Brahman. Him one must know, the supreme lord of all lords, the supreme Godhead above all Godheads. Supreme too is his Shakti, and manifold the natural working of her knowledge and her force. One Godhead, occult in all beings, the inner self of all beings, the all-pervading, absolute without qualities, the overseer of all actions, the witness, the knower. Shvetashvatara Upanishad. There is then a supreme reality, eternal, absolute and infinite. Because it is absolute and infinite, it is in its essence indeterminable. It is indefinable and inconceivable by finite and defining mind. It is ineffable by a mind-created speech. It is describable neither by our negations, neti neti, for we cannot limit it by saying it is not this, it is not that, nor by our affirmations, for we cannot fix it by saying it is this, it is that, iti iti. And yet, though in this way unknowable to us, it is not altogether and in every way unknowable. It is self-evident to itself, and, although inexpressible, yet self-evident to a knowledge by identity of which the spiritual being in us must be capable. For that spiritual being is in its essence and its original and intimate reality, not other than this supreme existence.
So here, as usual, Sri Aurobindo foregrounds the chapter with some quotations, and maybe I could say a few words about those quotations to start with. The first one comes from the Gita. It is there in beings, indivisible and as if divided. And there we see what we were just discussing, in the sense that there is an avidya, which is a self-dividing quality within being. It is as if necessary to its self-manifestation as an evolving reality is this self-division. Self-division brings an instability into the unity of being. And this instability is what causes it to move towards stability again. It is a kind of self-integrating impulse that enters the cosmos. So, yet, it is indivisible. The sense of being divided is an appearance only. And that's the point he's making. There is another Upanishad that talks about the senses of the creature being fastened with their doors outwards. It is this fastening. It is as if the mechanics, the construction of the self in its appearance in the cosmos is held together by fasteners which turn the experience outwards. But therefore that experience is the experience of the many, the experience of the divided self. And yet, within each being, there is the experience or the self-evident sense of the one and only one that exists, the undivided, the indivisible. So that is the polarity or dichotomy that he foregrounds in that first single sentence from the Gita. The second one, Brahman, the truth, the knowledge, the infinite. And we've already seen how he shows the self-appearance of Sat, Chit and Ananda. Sat is extends itself as the truth. Chit as knowledge and will. So here it is the knowledge. And Ananda is interestingly pointed to by Sri Aurobindo as presenting itself through the sense of the infinite as well as of freedom. Infinity is the foundation of freedom, of absolute freedom. And these are essential or intrinsic features of delight. Bliss arises due to the intrinsic nature of freedom. And freedom is the essential quality of infinity. So this is how we find that, in a sense, Sat, Chit and Ananda are manifesting as truth, knowledge, and the infinite. So this is Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam. These are the three objective appearances of Brahman, as Sri Aurobindo points out in his text, The Philosophy of the Upanishads. The third one, again from the Gita, is very interesting. No Purusha and Prakriti to be both eternal without beginning. And this is the primary duality, the primary two-ness of the real. Because, again, to manifest, you always need two. The manifestation depends on the separation of the one into the two and the relationship of the two. And this is not something that happens at some time. It is not something that emerges and disappears. It is not subject to time, but it is beginningless and endless. The duality is as primary as the unity. So this is the point that the Gita is making. In later philosophies of India, such as Sankhya, this has been seen or made into the foundation of a radical dualism. In other words, they see all reality as being subject to this two-ness, which will never be resolved. In other words, it's an unresolvable dialectic. Now, this is true to some extent, because indeed that is what gives perpetual scope to the manifestation. The manifestation will never end because there is a two-ness to it that will never be exhausted. There is no resolution that will ultimately flatten the two into a one. But on the other hand, what the Sankhya misses out is that first sentence, which is also coming from the Gita. The Gita is correcting the exclusive dualism of Sankhya by pointing to the fact that the two are nothing but the one. It is the one as the two. The two and the one coexist. It is there in beings indivisible and as if divided. The two is a originary self-appearance of the one. Originary and therefore beginningless and endless. So that is again related to what we have discussed earlier as the coexistence of the saguna and the nirguna. On the other hand, we have the other two, which are coming from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. The Shvetashvatara Upanishad is one of the great primary 10 or 13 Upanishads, and it is one of the first times that Shiva is made into the primary Godhead. So we find that this is the great Upanishad of Shiva. And here Shiva is Ishvara, or the Lord. And that's why here there is an equation of these primary attributes that Sri Aurobindo has introduced. Brahman, Purusha and Ishvara, they all are brought into focus as the Lord of existence. And so one must know Maya as Prakriti and the master of Maya as the great Lord of all. Now, Maya as Prakriti. So here we find that Maya is a term again which appears in the Upanishads as related to Brahman, as Brahman's power of creative consciousness, of self-conception. So ultimately we find that later philosophies like that of Shankara have called Maya a illusioning or illusion-making faculty within Brahman. But Sri Aurobindo points out that in the Upanishads, Maya is a self-conceptive faculty of Brahman. In other words, Brahman can conceive of itself in innumerable ways, in infinite ways, through its self-conceptions. So it observes itself. By what power will it observe itself? How will it reflect on itself? Its reflexive turn is its own infinity turned upon itself. And that is Maya. So Maya, as a self-conceptive power of Brahman, actually creates realities through its self-conception. As soon as it conceives of Brahman in a certain way, that self-conception becomes a reality, because there is nothing other. It is not a mental self-conception, which is an abstraction, but it is a real self-conception, as Sri Aurobindo calls supermind, real idea. This is reality, self-conception as reality. So these realities are then presided over and entered into by Brahman. They are nothing other than Brahman, and Brahman exists in each of them as its inner presence, but also its inner controller, antaryamin, inner controller, and therefore its Lord. The word Lord specifically has to do with control by will, with the faculty of knowledge called Ajnana. So here we find that the equation of Brahman and Ishvara is being made through showing that Maya is nothing but Prakriti. Maya as Prakriti means that which self conceives then becomes the ground of the manifestation of that self conception. This is also what Sri Aurobindo calls the holocaust of the Prakriti, the holocaust of the Divine Mother, because that which conceives then gives itself to the conception, becomes the ground of the conception, and the energy by which that conception manifests. And the Lord of that, the will which holds that together, is the Ishvara. So Brahman becomes master or Ishvara, and Maya becomes Prakriti or ground of manifesting energy. It is the might of the Godhead in the world that turns the wheel of Brahman. Again we find, as I said, Shvetashvatara Upanishad is primarily concerned with the Lord, with the power. Just as the Isha Upanishad means the Upanishad of the Lord, of he who has Ish, which means will. So it is the might of the Godhead in the world that turns the wheel of Brahman. Him one must know, the Supreme Lord of all Lords, the Supreme Godhead above all Godheads. Supreme too is his Shakti, and manifold the natural working of her knowledge and her force. One Godhead, occult in all beings, the inner self of all beings, the all-pervading, absolute without qualities, the overseer of all actions, the witness, the knower. So again, essentially what is being pointed out is the self-manifestation of the one who is unknowable, the one without qualities, the one who extends itself as the two. And out of the two, and the relating of the two, the relationship of the two, the one comes into a manifestation, which is a representation, from the self-presentation to the representation. And in the representation becomes the holder of the control, the controller, the inner effectuator of the manifestation, and therefore the Lord of all things. So I think these are the ways in which Sri Aurobindo foregrounds this particular chapter, preparing us for the way the one becomes the two, and the two has the property of manifesting and of control over the manifestation. That first paragraph is something which in a way summarizes what we have read in the previous paragraph, our previous chapter, the infinity of the one, the infinity of reality, the inconceivability of it, and yet the self-evident nature of it. Again, we find that descriptions represent. All descriptions belong to the reflexive turn. Descriptions are the ways by which Maya extends the self-conceptions of the one. But all these self-conceptions are partial. None of them can exhaust the one. Just as our own descriptions of ourselves, however we undertake them, always and in every way are just that, descriptions. And outside of descriptions, we know ourselves in a self-evident fashion that cannot be exhausted, that will remain inexpressible. So that is the point that Sri Aurobindo is making, but that inexpressible thing, it resides in each of us, and therefore we know it. Our knowledge of the self-knowing inexpressible reality proceeds from there being nothing but that self-evident inexpressible reality, and the truth of each of us being nothing but that. Question.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes, thank you. But although thus indeterminable to mind, because of its absoluteness and infinity, we discover that this supreme and eternal infinite determines itself to our consciousness in the universe by real and fundamental truths of its being, which are beyond the universe and in it, and are the very foundation of its existence. These truths present themselves to our conceptual cognition as the fundamental aspects in which we see and experience the omnipresent reality. In themselves, they are seized directly, not by intellectual understanding, but by a spiritual intuition, a spiritual experience in the very substance of our consciousness. But they can also be caught at in conception by a large and plastic idea, and can be expressed in some sort by a plastic speech which does not insist too much on rigid definition or limit the wideness and subtlety of the idea. In order to express this experience or this idea with any nearness, a language has to be created, which is at once intuitively metaphysical and revealingly poetic. Advenic significant and living images as the vehicle of a close, suggestive, and vivid indication, a language such as we find hammered out into a subtle and pregnant massiveness in the Veda and the Upanishads. In the ordinary tongue of metaphysical thought, we have to be content with a distant indication, an approximation by abstractions, which may still be of some service to our intellect, for it is this kind of speech which suits our method of logical and rational understanding. But if it is to be of real service, the intellect must consent to pass out of the bounds of a finite logic and accustom itself to the logic of the infinite. On this condition alone, by this way of seeing and thinking, it ceases to be paradoxical or futile to speak of the ineffable. But if we insist on applying a finite logic to the infinite, the omnipresent reality will escape us, and we shall grasp instead an abstract shadow, a dead form petrified into speech, or a hard, incisive graph which speaks of the reality but does not express it. Our way of knowing must be appropriate to that which is to be known. Otherwise, we achieve only a distant speculation, a figure of knowledge, and not veritable knowledge.
So, as we can see, the first part of that paragraph relates or connects with what we studied and what I read from the previous chapter, the truths of being. ultimately the self-presentation of being in its primary qualities. The primary qualities by which being presents itself to itself. What are its most primary features? And therefore, these truths arise from outside the universe, as he says. They have their being beyond the universe. But they also form the very fabric of the universe. They are in it. So beyond the universe and in it, and are the very foundation of its existence, as he says over there. Now, these become our ways of knowing or realizing the omnipresent reality. Fundamental aspects in which we see and experience the omnipresent reality. Each of these can be a door to that reality. And the reality is all these at once. This is partly the reason why the Gita, which is a great theistic text, places all these truths of being in the person of Krishna. And Krishna says to Arjuna that the Brahman is knowable in all its varied aspects to the great knowers, but all of them inhere in me as person. If you concentrate on me, you will know how they are all present at once. See, this is a certain kind of approach of theism. And in fact, Ishvara, the idea of Ishvara, proceeds along that line. It foregrounds person as that to which we can relate as persons and experience at once the truths of being, all contained in that one. So here he starts by talking about that and the fact that that is something which in a way seems distant to us and in another way seems near to us, because it is the essence of all existence. The root of all these truths, the truth of all these truths. So then he points out, he moves into the question of expression. And how can we know and express it? Express it again brings us into contact with the reflexive property. To know by identity and to know by description. These are two forms of knowing. To know by description is to represent, and to represent is to fragment. And particularly at the level of mind, that fragmentation is the realm of the many, the realm of the self-divided one. And hence, language can occur in three different stations. And that is what he's pointing to here. So there is an original station of language. This is the pranava. This is the supreme, undivided one that the Mandukya Upanishad speaks of as the Om, as that which has manifestations in the waking world, the dreaming world, and the two worlds of trance. Ultimately, beyond the world of highest trance, in the unknowable, the fourth that cannot be named. So this is the origin of expression, because expression is ultimately not a representation, but a self-presentation. It is Prakriti that is coeval with Purusha. it is Purusha's self-manifestation. So this is, in a way, the origin of the word. But that then passes through the three other stations, the trance of supermind, the dream of overmind, and the waking of the world of matter, life, and mind. So in each of these stations, the word changes its quality. Down here in the world of matter, life, and mind, it is the word divided among the divided. And hence, the word has a conventional property. It operates by convention only. It operates by what we decide in our manyness to give it in terms of its varied meanings. And the syntax by which we fix its logical meaning. So that becomes the divided word that can only describe a divided reality. So between these, between this form of the word, which the tantrics called Vaikari Vak, and the supreme word, is what is called Pashyanti Vak, which is the word of sight, the word of seeing. The word of seeing is the intuitive word. It is the intermediary plane, and it is connected with what Sri Aurobindo calls building an intuitive mentality. So that is what he's pointing to here. Just as he said earlier that self-evident experience resides in all of us, so too, there is a way by which that self-evident experience travels through the inner world and connects with the outer world. And that is the plastic speech that he's talking about. In themselves, they are seized directly, not by intellectual understanding, but by a spiritual intuition, a spiritual experience in the very substance of our consciousness. But they can be also caught at in conception by a large and plastic idea and can be expressed in some sort by a plastic speech. This connects to that other second paragraph from the previous chapter that I read that says that we have in us that intermediary realm, that even though we reside with our senses fastened outwards in the divided world, yet the entirety of Brahman is present in each of us. And how can we connect the two? That becomes part of the work of yoga. Yoga, uniting, union. Developing that intuitive idea and developing that plastic speech are part of that yoga. So here he's saying, what is the nature of that speech? What is the nature of the Pashyanti Vak? In order to express this experience or this idea with any nearness, a language has to be created, which is at once intuitively metaphysical and revealingly poetic. So these are the two primary qualities or attributes of that language of Pashyanti Vak. Intuitively metaphysical and revealingly poetic. And in those two terms, very interestingly, Sri Aurobindo has encompassed the two kinds of languaging available to our greatest, revelations in language. That is the Gita, the Veda and the Upanishad. The Veda and the Upanishad have been called Shruti. Shruti means that which is spoken. And that which is spoken, Sri Aurobindo connects with the revelation, the power of self-revelation, the word, the highest levels of the word, coming through language. And therefore, we find that these two attributes, what he calls the revealingly poetic, are present in these texts. In the Veda, it occurs through the power of poetic symbology. So there is a way by which idea turns into a luminous and revealing symbol, not just a conceptive symbol, but a real symbol. And that's what he says, that these are the realities that are seen and heard at the same time by which the one presents itself. And these are the images that become the varied objects of our world, the archetypes, one may say. And in the Upanishads, these are presented in what he calls a metaphysical, intuitively metaphysical language. An intuitively metaphysical language that seems to the external language almost paradoxical, actually paradoxical. So that which sees and connects the deepest with the outermost puts the finite in contact with the infinite, speaks paradoxically, but at the same time it speaks in a, what he calls, metaphysical, intuitively metaphysical manner, which is easy to understand by he who has the experience, but incomprehensible to him who resides outside the experience. So this is the point that he's making. And language, this paragraph is very, in a way, important to Sri Aurobindo, because language assumes for him a very important place in the project of the life divine. Language, see, there's another great philosopher, Heidegger, who has a phrase where he says, language is the house of being. Language is the house of being because it is the house in which we all reside. It is the common currency of our self, of our communication, of our exchange. It makes the world common to us. Depending on the language that we can use with each other, we can bring to manifestation a collective world. Hence, if we can use a certain kind of language, which is the language of metaphysical intuition, we can bring the one into the world of the many. This is the reason why Sri Aurobindo gives so much importance to this kind of holding to a language of the seeing word.
Metaphysical, the word metaphysical, is it not always applicable for all language, meaning all words, meaning it can never be totally physical, right?
Yes, but you see, because metaphysical doesn't mean only non-physical. Metaphysical meaning that which exists as the conceptions behind the physical. The world of ideas which give rise to the physical. In other words, the physical world can be explained through the ideas that belong to the metaphysical. So metaphysical intuition applies to coming into contact with the conceptive realm that has made itself manifest as the physical. So that is the nature of that word.
One more time, conceptive realm?
That has made itself manifest as the physical world.
Okay, so metaphysical language is what, I mean, that which describes that conceptive realm.
Or not even describes, in a way speaks from that conceptive realm. In other words, it is the language of that conceptive realm. The metaphysically intuitive language is the language that brings the physical world into contact with its own self-conceptions, that expresses, not only describes, because description again brings a certain division between a reality and its expression, but is speaking from the experience of that conceptive realm, which has become this world.
Thank you very much.
So, are you saying, Devishish, that the poetic and the metaphysical are two ways of this world behind the physical expressing itself to a physical, or expressing itself in a physical world?
Yeah, I would say not only the poetic and the metaphysical, I think he's bringing them together. We could call it the poetically metaphysical. But I think the two ways that I was mentioning are the symbolic and the metaphysical are two poetic ways by which this can be done. The Vedas approach through the symbolical door. They tap into a world of symbols. And the Upanishads approach through a more intuitively metaphysical way. They pare down the symbols into the conceptions or ideas that inhere in those symbols. This is also, it's very interesting because this also relates to the relationship between ideas and symbols. And symbols or archetypes are already self-generated, swayambhu in that sense, self-born ideas, ideas that have taken being. But ideas can exist in a more unstable condition as forms of becoming. In other words, we can find ideas generating many symbols. The same idea or same set of ideas can generate symbols along a gradient of different relations. And each of these will be a certain kind of symbol. So there can be a very fine-tuned realm of symbols related to sets of ideas that are in relation to each other. You can express through either of these dimensions. Both these dimensions open themselves up to its own poetics. And poetic speech can move along these two dimensions or combine them. And that is what happens in the Vedas and the Upanishads. In the early Upanishads, you actually find a combination of these two. You find both the symbolic as well as the metaphysical. The Isha Upanishad is a very good example of that, where a lot of it is very bare, paradoxical and metaphysical. And some of it is very, very mystically symbolical. So you find that these two become the two doors through which one can approach this inner language.
So these metaphysical and poetic, I mean, could it be that it's that intelligence or idea of that conceptive realm and the force or will of that same realm, meaning the knowledge and the will that can descend from that higher realm through these two doors?
Yeah, surely. Yeah, so this, the metaphysical and, again, both of them are poetic. It's more the symbolical and the metaphysical. They are both poetic. They are two forms of poetic speech. So we find that with the metaphysical, we are in contact with the knowledge. And with the symbolical, we are in contact not only with the force, but I would say with the truth that has become, or we could say, the beings of the truth, the beings of the ideas. That is what we find. And with the other, we find the knowledge and the will. Both of them are present there. So we can say knowledge and will, which are the self-presentations of chit or consciousness, are more primarily expressed through the power of metaphysical poetics, while we can say that the power of truth or sat and ananda are expressed more powerfully through the beings that are that are spoken of through symbol.
Margaret Paynes, would you like to read next?
Okay. The supreme truth aspect, which thus manifests itself to us, is an eternal and infinite and absolute self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight of being. This founds all things and secretly supports and pervades all things. This self-existence reveals itself again in three terms of its essential nature: self, conscious being or spirit, and God or the divine being. The Indian terms are more satisfactory. Brahma, the reality, is Atman. Purusha, Ishvara. For these terms grew from a root of intuition, and while they have a comprehensive preciseness, are capable of a plastic application, which avoids both vagueness in the use and the rigid snare of a too limiting intellectual concept. The supreme Brahman is that which in Western metaphysics is called the absolute. But Brahman is at the same time the omnipresent reality in which all that is relative exists as its forms or its movements. This is an absolute which takes all relativities in its embrace. The Upanishads affirm that all this is the Brahman. Mind is Brahman. Life is Brahman. Matter is Brahman. Addressing Vayu, the Lord of air, of life, it is said, O Vayu, thou art manifest Brahman. And pointing to man and beast and bird and insect, each separately is identified with the one. O Brahman, thou art this old man and boy and girl, this bird, this insect. Brahman is the consciousness that knows itself in all that exists. Brahman is the force that sustains the power of God and Titan and demon, the force that acts in man and animal and the forms and energies of nature. Brahman is the Ananda, the secret bliss of existence, which is the ether of our being and without which none could breathe or live. Brahman is the inner soul in all. It has taken a form in correspondence with each creature. created form which it inhabits. The Lord of beings is that which is conscious in the conscious being, but he is also the conscious in inconscient things, the one who is master and in control of the many that are passive in the hands of force nature. He is the timeless and time. He is space and all that is in space. He is causality and the cause and the effect. He is the thinker and his thought, the warrior and his courage, the gambler and his dice throw. All realities and all aspects and all semblances are the Brahman. Brahman is the absolute, the transcendent and incommunicable, the supracosmic existence that sustains the cosmos, the cosmic self that upholds all beings, but it is too the self of each individual. The soul or psychic entity is an internal portion of the Ishva. It is his supreme nature or consciousness force that has become the living being in a world of living beings. The Brahman alone is, and because of it, all are. For all are the Brahman. This reality is the reality of everything that we see in self and nature. Brahman, the Ishvara, is all this by his yoga maya, by the power of his consciousness force put out in self-manifestation. He is the conscious being, soul, spirit, purusha, and it is by his nature, the force of his conscious self-existence, that he is all things. He is the Ishvara, the omniscient and omnipotent all-ruler. And it is by his Shakti, his conscious power, that he manifests himself in time and governs the universe. These and similar statements taken together are all comprehensive. It is possible for the mind to cut and select, to build a closed system and explain away all that does not fit within it. But it is on the complete and many-sided statement that we must take our stand if we have to acquire an integral knowledge.
Oh, that is probably the most powerful essay on the Brahman that I've read. Here he goes through those three terms as the primary, you know, self-presentation of being. And in the previous chapter we saw how he does that. And he points to them as fundamental intuition. He first describes them in the English language and then he translates them into Sanskrit. And so those three are self, conscious being or spirit, and God or the divine being. And as he points out, the reason it's more satisfactory to use the Sanskrit is that these terms in the English language have become too mired, and also they belong to another kind of conceptive universe. The primary difference is also something that we can see in this entire paragraph, which is, one may say, a grand statement of monism in pluralism. So, while when we talk about these terms in the English language, we are actually bringing them into a conceptive universe of monotheism. Monotheism is ultimately the foundation of the Abrahamic religions. And what it means is that there is one transcendent God. That God is the one to whom all must subserve. But he is the creator and he has a creation. So there is the duality of the creator-creation relationship. And this monism by which nothing but the one exists is something which fits uneasily into that kind of world, conceptive world. That's partly the reason why he brings it quickly out of those English descriptions into the world in which they are more natural. And that is the three terms, Atman, Purusha and Ishvara. Metaphysically speaking, as he says, Atman is self. Atman can be thought of more in psychological terms. It's the sense of self that is in all things. To what extent is the sense of self present in things? That is its Atman. Now we talk about self as ego, but the Sanskrit makes the distinction between ahankara and Atman. Ahankara is aham. Aham is actually I. Aham is really the sense of self. Ahamkara is like the self function or the one which makes self, the making of self, self-made or construct of self, the self-construct, because kara is related to kriya, to make. So it is really a constructed self. It's important to see it as that, because ahankara literally means that. It means the constructed self. And Atman is that which is unmanifest. It's the sense of self that is at the root of things, of our own, sense of individuality. But at the same time, it transcends our sense of individuality. It is that which persists from self to self that we take from life to life. Or within this very life, if we may change our personality through evolution. The other one, conscious being or spirit. Now this is sometimes difficult to distinguish from sense of self, because sense of self inheres in conscious being. If there is something which is conscious in us, we may say that immediately we think of it as an I. But in certain states or experiences, which are very primordial, we may experience the sense of consciousness, of being conscious, free of the sense of self. It is possible to experience that we are conscious without really knowing who it is that is conscious. That division is possible, but usually they inhere in each other. Once, as soon as we think of what is conscious in us, we think of that as ourself. On the other hand, this conscious being has other properties as well. It has properties of expression. And that's the reason why Purusha, which is the Sanskrit term that he is using to map to conscious being or spirit, is also and may be better translated as person. It is the person in us. It is the sense of personhood. The sense of self may exist more abstractly than the sense of personhood or essential individuality within us. The third is the sense of the Lord, Ishvara, and that relates to will. Wherever will is involved, Ishvara makes his appearance, because it is that which exercises will in us, controls, has power over all the various features and expressions that are expressed by the self or the person. So those are the three kinds of entities or kinds of features by which self-existence reveals itself in us. And then he goes into this long description of monism in pluralism, as I said, that there is nothing but that. That is the primary intuition and the primary tenet of the Upanishads. And in a way, it's very important to keep that primary tenet alive in our thinking. That is why that all this is the Brahman. That's the first and most important tent pole, you may say, that holds the manifestation together. And that has to be the foundation of yoga. There is nothing but the one. And then he goes into to the various ramifications of that. Outside of all this is the one. Within all this is the one. In each of these is the one. And those are the three major stations, the transcendental, the universal, and the individual, through which the one manifests itself. Those Upanishadic statements that he describes there, first, the Upanishads affirm that all this is the Brahman. That is one of the Mahavakyas or great truths, foundations of the Upanishads. The other three, mind is the Brahman, life is Brahman, matter is Brahman, come from the Taittiriya Upanishad and the meditations of Bhrigu, where he is asked to meditate by his father on what is Brahman. And he comes back repeatedly saying, matter is Brahman, life is Brahman, mind is Brahman, etc. And sometimes it is thought that each one he says is a mistake, so his father sends him back again. But as Sri Aurobindo points out, they are not mistakes. Each one is nothing but the Brahman, except that they cannot be taken as the as all there is to the Brahman. The Brahman is also life, the Brahman is also mind, and it is only beyond mind that one starts coming across an integral formulation of Brahman. When he can say supermind, that is Brahman, or delight, ananda, that is Brahman, that is when Bhrigu starts experiencing the integral Brahman. Then the other one, pointing to man and beast and bird and insect, each separately is identified with the one, and that sentence he quotes, that is taken from the Gita. And that is related to what Krishna is telling Arjuna to meditate on in terms of the fact that there is nothing but the Brahman. Everything that you look at, one has to be equal to. This is the great teaching of equality. The yogi is equal to all these beings, because in each one there is the totality of being. Brahman alone resides. The next one is very interesting, because that is where he points to the fact that our conceptions of good and evil are also undercut by the Brahman. Brahman is the force that sustains the power of God and Titan and demon. In other words, good and evil are a duality that is part of the play of Brahman, and neither is good anything other than the Brahman, nor is evil anything other than the Brahman. Then he goes on to talk about the fact that that is the one that is conscious in all beings, conscious in itself, conscious in the inconscient, and master and controller of those who are passive in the hands of force nature. In other words, Prakriti and its manifestations yet are under the control. So there is nothing outside the control of Brahman. Brahman is present as self in all these things. Brahman is the person in each of these persons. Brahman is the force that animates all these forces. And Brahman is the controller of the force in each of the beings in this universe. Then the determinants of experience, time and space, are the self-extensions of Brahman. Brahman is those things, and Brahman is beyond those things. Time, space, and causation, these are the three determinants of experience. And then he goes on to talk about the thinker, the warrior, and the gambler. And that is again very interesting, because the thinker and warrior are two modes of self-manifestation of the Brahman as Brahmin and Kshatriya. The gambler, we may take that as a manifestation of the Vaishya, but it also pertains to the becoming in a very critical manner, because, you know, it's, as Nietzsche points out, in a sense, true becoming is all gambling. It's gambling because it's risk-taking. It's risk-taking because we push our limits into the unknown in every step that we take in relation with the unknowable. See, this is the whole nature of becoming as a self-exceeding. It is a gamble because it is never given to us. So that kind of becoming is also undertaken by nothing but the Brahman. All realities and all aspects and all semblances are the Brahman. Realities, aspects and semblances that are, reality is the truth. Aspects are presentations. Semblances are representations. And all three are nothing but the Brahman. Brahman is the absolute, the transcendent, the incommunicable, the supra-cosmic existence that sustains the cosmos. So he's talking about that which is the radical infinity, that which is the unknowable beyond all knowables, and yet he relates that to the world that is knowable, and that is the unknown, the cosmic. The supra-cosmic sustains the cosmos. The cosmic self that upholds all beings. This is the cosmic Purusha or the overmental Purusha through whom the supramental manifests. But it is to the self of each individual. So here again we find him affirming the triple status of the Brahman. The Brahman is transcendental, the Brahman is cosmic, and the Brahman is individual and individualized. That individual self is then being defined by him as the soul or psychic entity. That is an eternal portion of the Ishvara. Eternal portion.
Hello?
Yeah, that eternal portion of the Ishvara is what the Gita says, Amsa Sanatana. He is translating that term of the Gita. The Gita uses two terms to talk about the soul or the psychic being. One is Amsa Sanatana, that is eternal portion, a portion that will never dissolve, because it is that one that has become atomic in that portion. But it also says that it is a self-becoming of the Prakriti, of the Shakti. Amsa Sanatana, and also Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta, the individual becoming of the Para Prakriti. So it is both Ishvara and Shakti that is present in each psychic being.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just looking at this part. I've lost that particular portion. Then he goes into this. Okay, soul or psychic entity is the eternal portion. It is his supreme nature or consciousness force that has become the living being in a world of living beings. Exactly, those two sentences. The soul or psychic entity is an eternal portion of the Ishvara. It is his supreme nature or consciousness force that has become the living being in a world of living beings. These two sentences characterize those two sentences from the Gita. That is Amsa Sanatana and Para Prakritir Jiva Bhuta. The eternal portion of the supreme being and the individual becoming of the Supreme Consciousness Force. The Brahman alone is, and because of it all are, for all are the Brahman. That is again the complete monism of the Upanishads. This reality is the reality of everything that we see in self and nature. Brahman the Ishvara is all this by his yoga maya. So here he brings the maya into the picture as that by which or by whose power Brahman becomes the appearances and semblances of this cosmos. By power of his consciousness force put out in self-manifestation. He is conscious being, soul, spirit, Purusha, and it is by his nature, the force of his conscious self-existence, that he is these things. So here, the first one, by his yoga maya, by power of consciousness put out in self-manifestation, he takes on these appearances. That is the maya. The second one, that by his nature, he is all these things, is that once the semblance has been created, what upholds it? What are the laws by which it is run? What are the mechanics of the machine? That is Prakriti. See, the self-conception is made by Maya. The dynamism of the automatisms of each being is held together by the Prakriti. And the third, when he is Ishvara, the omniscient and omnipotent all-ruler, and by his Shakti, his conscious power, he manifests himself in time and governs the universe. So, consciousness force is Shakti. So we see three things here. Conception, automatism, and conscious force. These are the three stations of the Divine Mother, that she manifests by conceiving of the self manifestations or representations of Brahman. She enters into them, that is the holocaust of Prakriti, is the entrance into each of them as a form of habit, a form of habit, which is the Prakriti. And actually being the conscious force that can hold that form of habit and break it when it wants to, that is the Shakti. Those are the three stations of the Prakriti of the Divine Mother that correspond to the three stations of the Brahman as Self, Person, and Lord.
So, Devajista, there is quite a lot in this paragraph. And perhaps we should again, you know, if it's okay with you, we can just summarize it again next time before we start the next class.
Sure.
Because it seems that, it seems that it's long and it's also pretty intense, so... perhaps we can, and also given it's 9:35, perhaps we can stop here and continue next class with the overview of this paragraph before we continue.
Okay, sure.
So let's stop this here and we can have a discussion next time and have any questions, etc. The next class, which I suppose should be the second Saturday of December.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. We'll continue on the second Saturday of December.
Okay.
Thank you, Baba.
Okay.
Thank you very Thanks. Much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great session, actually. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Debush.
কোথা থেকে এসেছি? I know.